21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Zoe Hieronymus.
It's all about soul. It's all about faith and a deeper devotion. It's all about soul. 'Cause under love is a stronger emotion.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Zoe Hieronymus. Laura Kortner is our executive producer, and Kristen Haigrick runs our board. Joining us this hour is Dr. Larry Dalsey, author of at least 11 other books that I could count, such as The Power of Premonition, Reinventing Medicine, Healing Words, and other wonderful books that have opened up new ways of seeing ourselves and how we influence each other, the world, and our own bodies through intention, attention, and care. In Dalsey's most recent Hay House 2013 release, he has focused on the universal question, also the title of his book, One Mind, How Our Individual Mind is Part of a Greater Consciousness and Why It Matters. I hope our audience will stay with us for a fascinating exploration of the general consensus Dalsey presents, taking from ancient and modern literature that proves we are indeed in the one mind, of the one mind, all of us together, all energetically entangled, forever, as some would say, in the big soup of it all. Larry, thanks so much for coming on.
So it's great to be back with you.
It's been a while, and this is just a beautiful book, a serious book, and a really wonderful journey because it's really a collection of hundreds of stories.
Well, it is that. You know, that's one of the reasons we know that the one mind exists. People's experiences, you know, they're incessantly condemned as just anecdotes by skeptics, but I think that since they give us such a concerted and consistent story, we are obliged to take them seriously. But it's not just all stories. You know, the other angle that shows us that the one mind exists is actual experiments. So we have experiences as well as experiments that confirm, in my judgment, that the one mind is real.
How would you describe in a simple way what the one mind is?
Well, it's a domain of consciousness that serves as an umbrella, really, for all of the other subdivisions that we've made of consciousness. In the 20th century, we just sort of took the mind apart into superego, id, and ego, and the collective conscious and the unconscious, preconscious, subconscious, and all of that sort of thing. But there's another way of looking at the mind. If we look in the telescope from the other direction, we can see a unity and a way in which all of these subcomponents fit together. So that's what I've tried to do. I think that the one mind is just a dimension of consciousness that includes all the other parts. All the other individual minds that we obviously have, they come together to form a unity and a connectedness that is all-inclusive. And this really isn't a far-out idea. It's actually one of the most consistent ways of thinking about consciousness that's occurred in the history of the human race. It goes back at least 3,000 years to the Akashic records and the old Hindu aphorism, Tatvamasi, you're it.
And the beautiful thing of the way you've gone about showing through both experience and experiment that this is so. And I think it's a beautiful contribution, Larry, because you've taken both the ancient and the modern and woven them together and shown as an example that quantum physics has contributed quite a bit to sort of asserting what the spiritual traditions have always said, that the God, body, mind are all together and we're all in it.
Well, that is really what I've tried to do. I think we're farther ahead if we can marry ancient wisdom with modern insights, particularly from quantum physics, which is the most accurate science ever invented. And if you look at some of the hypotheses and theories that are coming out of quantum mechanics these days, there's a decisive spiritual component to these ideas, this idea of entanglement, which almost nobody argues with anymore, is just a dead ringer for some of the metaphorical descriptions that came out of ancient Eastern wisdom 3,000 years ago. So I think that we're, sort of kicking and screaming and their way toward an understanding, a scientific understanding of some of the truths that have been there for quite a long time in the history of the human race.
Absolutely. And it's nice that you make a comment that the belief that the brain produces the mind has gotten in the way of our looking at the one mind from a broader, bigger point of view. And I would agree with you entirely. How has that hampered us as a humanity?
Well, in more ways than I can count. I think the worst thing that it has done is to strip us of all hope of survival of bodily death. As a physician, this really concerns me because I believe that the fear of death and annihilation has caused more suffering in the history of the human race than all the physical diseases combined. And to say that the brain makes consciousness and that consciousness is the equivalent of the physiology and anatomy of the brain is the death sentence, literally, because it has no hope of any sort of survival of what we consider to be higher cognition powers and awareness and so on. That all goes with the brain. As Bertrand Russell trenchantly put it years ago, when I die, I shall rot, and nothing of my ego shall remain. It's just a very dismal point of view, and I don't think there's any science to support it myself.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, I think all the evidence is in the other direction. I think we can decisively point to lines of evidence which show that we're not done with the death of the brain and body. And I think that this is really important in terms of providing meaning and hope, which is really, really something that makes life worthwhile.
Well, and I think, as you also point out, we're in pretty desperate times, and it requires a different way of viewing both our capacities and our purpose and what we're here to do. I love the fact that you show that, you know, as examples, you know, you talk about reincarnation, remote viewing. I mean, here's a good example. You talk about we have this awareness beyond our senses and over distances, and that animals, as an example, you talk about Dr. J.B. and Sally Ryan at Duke University making a study of animals who are aware of things like the death of their master from great distances. I mean, you go a long way to give us all kinds of supportive evidence of what one mind looks like as it manifests. Talk to us a bit about that.
Well, I think that there are just scores of ways, if we open our imagination and really try to break this collective hypnosis that we've been dragooned into by denying any ability of the mind to reach out beyond the brain. If we look around, we can see all sorts of evidence that the brain does behave that way. One of my favorite sections in the book about reaching out and experiencing things beyond the limits of the brain has to do with something I call telesomatic phenomena, which are very common in identical twins. This is special interest to me because I am one. And my brother, my twin brother and I, have all of our life had this weird sense of connectedness that doesn't depend on being close to each other in any spatial sense. This operates at a distance, and we've just become accustomed to that. And besides that, I'm married to a twin, and my wife Barbara and her twin brother have had shared physical symptoms and thoughts all through their lives. So our household has been sort of a twin laboratory for all sorts of weird stuff. So I just sort of take it for granted that this is the way consciousness operates. But it isn't just with identical twins. You've mentioned the ability of certain animals to have these sorts of experiences too, and they're all over the place. I go into what looks like group consciousness and group mind by talking about the coordinated behaviors of flocks of birds, schools of fish, and herds of animals. It certainly looks like the creatures certainly experience a common form of consciousness that just cannot be explained in terms of the see, touch, feel world that we're told accounts for all this stuff. I just don't think it does.
Well, you told this. I love the story of Sam Rogers, who was a beekeeper.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember that story? It's a lovely one, if you don't mind sharing it.
Well, it's a little dim now, right now.
All right. Well, there's so many stories. You have several thousand stories in this book, but this was at his death. His own children walked around his cobbler's beehives. His father was a cobbler.
Right.
And told them that his father had passed on. And then the bees, of course, made note of it by coming to the services. I mean, it reminds me of the elephant whisperer when he passed away at mm-hmm. the Tula Range in Africa. The elephants came and paid their respect before anything had been announced about his passing.
Well, that's a great example. You know, that section, you've refreshed my memory a bit here. There's a section on the bees called Telling the Bees, and this is an old tradition, and tradition has it that when the beekeeper dies, that the family has to go and tell the bees that of the master's passing. And unless they did this, the bees would desert the hive and go off and start another hive. And so this has several layers to it. One is that we're not the only sentient creature walking around. Other creatures share in our consciousness and can perceive our thoughts and intentions and so on. So, there are just any number of those kinds of stories. And one of the key points about communication with animals is Rupert Sheldrake's exciting experiments on dogs that know when their owners are returning home. And this has been videoed at length. Before the master returns, the dog will go and stand by the window or the door and doesn't do this at other times. And you can you can't fake the dogs out by returning home at odd times or by different conveyances, whether it's returning by a bicycle or a motor vehicle or just walking. The dogs know.
Well, it's interesting, Larry, because earlier when you were talking about twins or people at great distances having a sense of what the other's feeling, or a doctor knowing when his patients are going in labor because he has pains in his chest, as you describe in one of your chapters, is that people come into empathy or into rapport, but animals do too. So, you know, there are trans-species Good Samaritans. It's not just humans who reach out to help.
Well, you know, I think this gets us to the point of this being a strategy for meeting the challenges that we face on the planet now. I mean, we're not in good shape, and time is not on our side. And to the extent that we feel connected and united with all of sentient life on Earth, this will be a motivating factor for us to do something definitive in meeting the challenges that we face, which are too numerous to name. So I think the idea of the one mind really is going to play a huge role if we're going to make it as a species on this earth, because it will catalyze our caring and our compassion and our willingness to do something definitive.
Well, and you, in the various stories you tell in the various chapters that really look at all the different ways one mind manifests, you had this beautiful story of an adventurer named Dushan Gersi, mm-hmm. who was in the Sahara with a nomad sitting there waiting for a friend. And it's just a description of what it used to be before there were telephones, before there were cell phones, before there were fax machines. All of us had much more heightened intuitive sensibilities than I think sometimes our culture is diminishing them with all of this technology.
Well, it used to be just the way people got on in life. Before what they were, we became so cell phone and smartphone and telephone dependent. People used these other senses, this sense of connectedness from consciousness, irrespective of spatial separation, just to live their lives. And the gentleman you mentioned, Dushan, also had an experience of having to go from a place in the northern Sahara down to Timbuktu, several hundred miles across trackless desert, and he hired a guide on the recommendation of a military commander at a post, and oddly enough, the guide was blind, and so Dushan could not understand how this was going to work, but this guy was just a feeling machine who had the ability to transcend his blindness and get them there in perfect shape. This is one of those almost unbelievable fictional-sounding instances, but there are just too many of them for us to disregard.
Well, and also you mentioned this wonderful story. I think it was anthropologist Ronald Rose who, when talking about the Aborigines, saying their messages are not in the smoke, meaning when they would send up smoke signals, but
right.
the smoke lets them know to tune in. It's like,
right.
hey, tune in to me.
Right. It was an attention-getting device, and it basically it said, you know, listen up.
Mm-hmm.
I've got something to say to you across great distances. And white people never got this. They always insisted that there was some secret code to the smoke, releasing the smoke billows. But time and again, the Aborigines would tell them that that's not so. This is a mind-to-mind thing. You know, if I might mention one of my favorite examples here, in the book, again, is twin-related, and it had to do with four-year-old identical twin girls in Spain in the 1970s, and what happened was that the father took one of the little girls to visit the grandparents tens of miles away. The other little girl stayed home to help her mom with chores, and unfortunately, in doing that, she touched her hand to a red-hot iron and erupted in a major second-degree burn, a huge blister on one part of her palm. And at the same time, miles and miles away at the grandparents' house, the other little girl erupted in a blister on the same part of the hand, the same configuration, at the same time as her sister did back at home with the mom. There's no way in the world that this could be explained by chance, although in desperation a lot of skeptics try to say that something like this happens by chance, but I just can't buy it.
You share numerous stories. One was of Joseph Chilton Pierce's son as a young child. But before we come back to that, I thought it was interesting because when you look back, we have to take a break, but when you look back at Goethe, I mean, you've drawn from so many wonderful mystics, intuitives, scientists, and yet they've all sort of been pointing to the same kind of participatory science, which is to become one with the thing we're looking at. So when we come back, Larry, we'll start there. Our guest, if you're just joining us, is Dr. Larry Dawsey. His new book, One Mind, How Our Individual Mind is Part of a Greater Consciousness and Why It Matters. It's a Hay House 2013 release, and you can go to www.dawseydawsey, D-O-S-S-E-Y twice.com, dawseydawsey.com.
Hi, this is Meir Schneider. You all know me as one who overcame blindness and developed the method of self-healing throughout the whole body. www.self-healing.org. And I would like to recommend very much the show of Zohar Hieronymus on radio. Have good listening.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. Dr. Larry Dawsey is with us. His newest book, a Hay House 2013 release, One Mind, How Our Individual Mind is Part of a Greater Consciousness and Why It Matters. So, Larry, before we go back to some of the very particulars, why does it matter that we're all one mind?
Well, I think it matters greatly. I am convinced that people who become familiar with this place in this space and consciousness or generally, on average, happier, and they're healthier, and they're more creative, and they're wiser than people who do not have this understanding. This is a way of overcoming a sense of isolation, and if there's one thing that is deadly for health, it's to live a life of isolation. We know now, with unimpeachable evidence, that the more united and that people feel with others, the more social contacts that they have a lower incidence of all the major diseases, and on average, they live much longer than people who live a life of isolation. And if there's any message to this one mind idea, it's that we're not isolated. We're connected in ways that are richer than we ever imagined. And the goal of a lifetime is just simply to learn how to realize this.
I remember you telling about years ago when you joined me when you realized the power of prayer and that you had to change your practice and pray for your patients. So when a person becomes aware that we are all connected and that my thoughts are literally affecting somebody millions of miles away and your thoughts are affecting me and everybody listening, their thoughts are affecting their neighbor, how does it change in terms of the way a person can view themselves as in a positive sense? Not, you know, a lot of people go, well, I don't want the responsibility. If my thoughts are really affecting the world, look out, world.
Well, I know. I bump into that all the time. I think one of the practical ways that it changes the way we live our lives is that it really does help us move away from a place of selfishness and greed. I've even suggested that it helps us recalibrate and upgrade the golden rule in which we usually say, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, which has always seemed very selfish to me. It helps us, this one mind idea, it helps us to renovate the golden rule to something like be compassionate to others, because in some sense they are you.
Yeah, for sure.
And so we move from a use of this, you know, idea of empathy and compassion away from considering it a metaphor or just a nice poetic way of thinking to something that is absolutely physically real. And when I use this term, one mind, I really mean it literally. I'm not talking metaphor or poetry here. I think it's time we just bit the bullet and say, this is who we are. Nature has designed us to be together, and to the extent that we ignore this, then we set ourselves up for bad behaviors, selfishness, and greed, which really now is threatening our fate on this particular planet.
All very true. You know, and it's interesting because you show how the near-death experience is one of the ways that people actually experience this oneness and sort of bring that kind of sense of integrity and wholeness back into their life. I know the books I've interviewed the authors on children who have had near-death experiences are much more responsible. They take care of their bodies. They're all involved in serving others. And so when you look at the literature that's out there and the change that's taking place right now with science and spiritualism sort of crossing paths, how do you see this affecting the capacity we have as a group to address the challenges that we're faced with?
Well, I think it gives us a whole new spirit, a different attitude toward what we're capable of. I know a lot of people who are extremely sensitive to environmental issues and things like global climate change and so on, who, although they recycle and change out their light bulbs and turn the thermostat down and all of those things that we all should be doing, they nonetheless, in another part of their being, really have a sense of hopelessness, that their activities, even though they're valuable, will never really make a significant difference. I think that this idea of the one mind is a shot in the arm and an antidote for that sense of helplessness, because it really unites us with 7 billion other people. And I think our great task now is to actualize this, because we really face challenges that are really new in terms of human history. We are the first generation who can actually glimpse an end, in my judgment. And so this changes this idea of the one mind from something that people might consider just purely philosophical and something that they could toy with, you know, at leisure. It changes to something that is absolutely crucial to get on with. I had the opportunity, before he died, of discussing with the famous physicist David Bohm whether or not he thought we were going to make it as a species. And he thought and thought, and finally he said, yes, Larry, we will make it barely. So, you know, that's come as a kind of consolation on some days to me. I would settle for barely. But in order for it to even be barely, as the way we make it, we're going to have to, I think, reshape our idea of what we're capable of. And I think this idea of the one mind is something that can reinvigorate everybody and give us maybe the best hope we have.
You know, it's interesting because my own new book, I came to a very similar conclusion that we're sort of on this precipice of either declaring that we are these divine beings and acting that way and using this capacity that we have, which can be accessed in the quiet of your meditation or your prayer,
right,
that makes a profound shift around the world, or we can go on with sort of the mundane geopolitical nonsense that we see planet-wide and not make the change. So I agree with you entirely that it's using this capacity, but actually using it as a humanity that is really the precipice we stand on. And I've always felt that when we became aware of our full embodied consciousness, that's actually the great challenge for humanity. And that's the greatest wild card. That's the good wild card.
Right.
So go ahead.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Well, I thought one of the things you pointed out was Goethe and many others who I've interviewed over the decades have talked about entering the subject of the thing we're studying, or participatory science, meaning if you're studying a plant, to really feel the plant, to intuit the relationship to the plant, not as an object but as a species.
Yes, to come at it from the inside, to mm-hmm. actually become what it is you're studying. This is, totally dishonored in almost all of modern science, in which we take things apart. And even in biology, we almost always do something destructive to something before we can even study it. But there is another way, and it's the way that is made possible by resacralizing the world to really consider it sacred. And with that comes an entirely new ethic and mm-hmm. way of changing our behavior.
No question about it. I agree with you entirely. You know, I actually coined a term that we've been living a death economy and we need to switch to a life economy. And the two of them are sort of a shorthand description of selfishness and selflessness.
Exactly.
But you include so many beautiful things in your book, and I really want to commend you for having done such sort of a cross-disciplinary study, because you even go so far as to talk about the automatic writing which William Butler Yeats and his wife Georgie Hyde Lees used.
Yep. I mean, and James Merrill too, the great modern poet, American poet. Georgie used the Ouija board to come up with just an endless stream of metaphors that were very rich and descriptive that Yeats used in his great poetic outpourings. And to his great credit, he gave her credit for doing this. I mean, he didn't keep it secret. And you know that he went on to become a president of the Parapsychological Association in England. So he was really out front with this. And so was James Merrill, the American poet. His partner also used the Ouija board to come up with ideas and phrases and metaphors, which Merrill freely used. And it isn't the Ouija board, in case we need to enlarge on this. I think it's just opening up the subconscious. The board is a vehicle for getting in touch with wisdom that is out there and available through, which I suggest, is this one mind, this pool of intelligence and information that is infinite. And it's been the goal of all creative geniuses to tap into that. I give a lot of examples in the book of people who have done exactly that. You know, I was surprised in my research to find out one of the people who was best at it is little known for it, and that's Thomas Edison, the great American inventor who gave us the electric light bulb and the phonograph and a lot of other breakthroughs. And Edison simply flat out said that he's never created anything. He said that he got impressions from the universe at large. And he worked them out, but he was only a receiving apparatus, he said. And he said that thoughts come from the outside. Well, this horrifies a lot of, neurobiologists these days who want to keep it all in the brain as the originating point for anything. So we do have these exemplars, though, that we could look to, you know, some of the greatest figures in modern science have taken this position that Edison took.
As they have in terms of the use of dreams, and you talk about this, that, you know, collective dreaming, individual dreaming, there are literally dream pathways that we can be using, each one of us, and it doesn't matter who we are, because when you're in that state, the soul is free to explore.
Well, during our dream life, we completely ignore the constraints of space and time, and you know, we're not afraid of embarrassing ourselves in our dreams. It's just you know, sort of an imaginary free for all, and that's where some great wisdom crops up. It's always been that way for creative geniuses. Dream pathways have been one of the great avenues for discovery, and remain so. If anybody wants to do something that might freshen up their one-mind participation, I would just say, you know, keep a dream journal. Almost everybody who does that, when you write it down in the morning or record it in some way, it tends to freshen up your dream life. They tend to be more colorful, and precognitive dreams tend to develop out of that. If you go to the trouble of paying attention to your dream life by virtue of writing it down, that honors it. And it invites a greater outpouring from the unconscious, which is still one of the best pathways into the one mind.
And yet it's so interesting. Before Ingo Swann passed away, we had a chance on many occasions to talk, and we used to talk about sort of power and how people weren't really taught that power comes within. And we were talking about these stealth powers of enhancing intuition. And how do you look at different cultures who do or don't enhance intuition? Because it seems to me that's sort of like a bottom line.
Well, it is it's a dividing line. I mean, we've almost given it away.
Yeah.
Here by assigning every creative instinct we have to, you know, neurotransmitters and so on in our brains, whereas in pre-modern cultures, and today still many pre-modern cultures have developed ways of enhancing intuition. And a lot of it's done through dream work. I talk about tribal peoples in the book who have learned to cultivate a nocturnal adventure through dreams and honoring it the next day by discussing what they dreamt and so on. So there, it's still the potential for this is still there, as these tribes remind us.
Right.
But in order for us to activate that, we've got to break this cultural hypnosis that has afflicted so many people in our culture, that you've got to do it by virtue of your own neurons inside your cranium. And I think that that's a deadly mistake.
We'll take a little break, then we'll be right back. Our guest is Dr. Larry Dawsey. His most recent mind, I encourage all of you to read it, because if you're a believer already from personal experience, this is a book to share with someone else who may just need some more exposure to themselves. One Mind, How Our Individual Mind is Part of a Greater Consciousness and Why It Matters. It's a Hay House 2013 release. You can learn more at Larry's website, www.dawseydawsey, D-O-S-S-E-Y, dawseydawsey.com.
You're listening to 21st Century Radio with Zoe and Bob Hieronymus. My name is Stefan Schwartz. It's my pleasure to be here. You're going to hear interesting conversation on this that you won't hear elsewhere. And you can find my work on www.schwartzreport.net or www.explorejournal.com/content/Schwartz. 21st Century Radio is leading this conversation of what a conscious world will look like.
Amen to that, Brother Stefan. Our guest currently is Dr. Larry Dawsey. His most recent book, a Hay House 2013 release, and third caller at 410-922-6680. That's 1-800-WCBM-680 will be a winner of Larry's book, One Mind, how our individual mind is part of a greater consciousness and why it matters. And folks, it's really one of those books that not only is the bibliography outstanding and the endnotes, but within the book, it's really an easy to read. You take your time at it, chapter at a time. You will just have a wonderful time reading it as well as sharing it with others. So, Larry, when we then look at one mind and one mind consciousness, as you point out, there's also a dark side of the one mind. Phenomena happens both in the good way with masses of people experiencing the same implications and the same sort of desires, but at the same time, there can be a dark side to this.
Yes, I think it's time we put that on the table, because if you leave it off, it misleads people. There's a tendency to think that all of this one-mind business is just sweetness and light, but, you know, there is this dark side to it, and we don't want to be Pollyannish about this. There is a series of papers now that have been published out of Harvard and Medical School and UC San Diego by James Fowler and Nicholas Christakis, and they look at what they call social network phenomena, by which they don't mean Facebook or Twitter or anything like that. But they have shown how experiences and thoughts and feelings and emotions get around in social groups. And they've shown that people whom you don't even know, who are thrice removed from you, for example, the friend of a friend of a friend, their ideas, their emotions can affect you in ways that are almost unimaginable. You know, if we call this by its proper term, I think we'd have to use the term telepathy. But they don't use that term. They just simply label this as social network phenomena and don't ask how it might happen. But this is weird stuff, not only because happiness gets around, but because they've shown also that negative feelings, depression, even the tendency to think about suicide, terrible health habits, the inclination toward obesity, diabetes, all are transferred from other people you don't know and will never meet in your life. This is one way of saying that it's not just the good stuff that gets around, like happiness and positive feelings. There's a dark side to this as well. I don't think this is a reason for us to throw up our hands and say, this is terrible, I don't want anything to do with it. Getting back to those tribal cultures we were talking about, they almost, too, without exception, believe in hexes and spells and negative stuff getting around, just like the positive stuff. And they have ways of protecting themselves from the negative stuff, the dark side, and they just do it gracefully and get on about their business. What we don't want to do is to give a false view of what the one mind is. We want to name it completely, and part of that involves, as you just said, talking about the dark side.
When we look at all that we know, and you did a beautiful job, by the way, of talking about Stefan Schwartz, who we heard from recently the other moment, as well as Hella Hamdi and all these wonderful remote viewers who did the early work. Stefan himself has talked about, you know, finding old artifacts and sunken ships at the Alexandrian port city in Egypt, etc. By the same token, though, each one of us has this ability to see everywhere and everywhen. And so when you talk about one mind as being a tool for us to use, I'm sure you've thought about what that would look like.
Well, I have, and I keep going back to actual examples that have popped up in the lives of real people. I think one of the great contributions that this idea of the one mind makes is that it makes a greater degree of wisdom possible in our life, because the one mind that is unlimited suggests that there may be a pool of wisdom that we could access, this reservoir of information that's infinite and eternal and without limit. And sometimes this participation in this pool of wisdom comes out in shocking ways. You may remember Joseph Chilton Pierce's story of his son.
Yeah.
The boy was 5 years old, and the time that this happened, Pierce was in his early teaching career at university, He was preparing an early morning lecture, and he says that he was obsessed by the relationship between God and humankind, and he was reading a lot of Carl Jung and so on, and he was struggling with his understanding. It was radically incomplete, but on this particular morning, his son, who was waiting for his ride to kindergarten, came in and sat down on the edge of the bed where Pierce was working, and he launched into a 20-minute discourse on the nature of God and humankind. Pierce said that he spoke in publishable, complex sentences. He used a language that was elegant, did not need any correction. And Pierce said that his young son told him everything there was to know about this field. And he said that he had the feeling of being in the presence of the uncanny. He began to weep because he knew that this was something absolutely remarkable. And then his son's ride came, and the horn honked, and his boy got up and left and didn't remember anything about it later. Well, Pierce certainly remembered a lot about it, and he said it would be 30 years when he was involved in meditation later that he would only be able to come up with anything resembling what his son had told him on that memorable day. That's what I mean by dipping into a pool of wisdom that I think is part of the one mind scenario. And this was a life-changing event for Pierce because he went on to talk about consciousness and cognition in ways that really made a difference in our culture.
No question about it. And as you talk about, you know, all of us sort of awakening to our responsibility to something higher, that this one-mindedness, that when we become aware of it, it changes how we would do everything and the questions we would ask.
And, you know, it does so because we, through the one-mind participation, we see that we're not different from all sentient life. We're connected with it. So if we harm it, we're harming ourselves, essentially. And we need to recycle the world to see it as holy, mm-hmm. something that is worthy to be preserved and not something simply to be greedy about and selfish about. So there are ethical dimensions here that flow from this idea of the one mind. One that concerns me as a physician, though, is the idea of health. If we're all connected, then the health of one person must affect the health of everyone else, so that personal health, while there is something to say for it, is not where we want to wind up when we talk about health, because we want to develop the idea that the health of one person affects the health of everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this has societal implications in how we design health care and reimbursement and all of that. This is a hugely practical idea, this idea of the one mind, because in large measure, it because of its ethical implications.
Well, and you look historically at just some of the wonderful studies of TM meditation lowering violence in a community, not mm-hmm. by necessarily those doing the meditating, meaning they aren't the violent ones, but that meditation itself can change the environment, change weather systems. I've always believed that our consciousness has the power to really drive the planet, and that might be our eventual idiom as humanity is without bodies and just consciousness. But in the meantime, we do have bodies some of the time, and some of the times we don't. So, Larry, when I look at all the different books you've written and all the different ways, whether it was Healing Words or Power of Premonition or Reinventing Medicine, and now One Mind, is there an area that you haven't tapped into that interests you beyond One Mind? Because I'm thinking, well, Larry,
yeah.
Now what? Off planet,
yeah.
I guess we go.
Well, I'm not written out. At least I hope I'm not. And there's always been a further elaboration of the books that have immediately preceded. And so I'm not one of these people who, you know, has a long range plan. I just sort of put one foot in front of the other every day, and I just try to, after finishing a book, I just try to empty out, and I just wait for you know, to be filled up with something, and I don't know what it will be, but I'm pretty sure it will be something.
Well, it's interesting because as a writer myself, although it takes me a little longer, you have a wonderful recovery rate. I wrote 3 books in 10 years, and I feel like if I didn't have to use my left hemisphere for about a decade, I'd be pretty happy. It should just sort of get that linear-itis. It's like, enough already of the words. But yeah. I think you really, in all honesty, I read all the new paradigm, all the scientists, et cetera. I think you've done something nobody's done yet, which is to, in very digestible terms, write a book that an average person, if they look at themselves honestly and look at some of these experiences that maybe they've held them very preciously close to their heart, you know, a premonitory dream, or that they had a coincidence that saved somebody's life, or they had such empathy that they themselves were a first responder and saved someone's life, which I thought was a beautiful way of talking about one mind, is that when we selflessly go to help somebody or something, it's a demonstration that we're all connected.
Well, I feel that way myself because of personal experiences, and what I want people to do if they read the book is to come away with the idea that we're already living the one mind. I mean, the ways we access this and the way it manifests itself in our daily lives, it's really hard not to get it once you become attuned to it.
I think that's very true. When I used to cover foreign affairs and current events, I would take the story and say, you know, have you ever acted like this dictator or this general or whatever? That we objectify everything. Everything's outside, out there, it's over there, it's them, when in fact everything we see is part of us.
No, that's right. And I keep coming back to the urgency of all of this. It's a great idea to play with, but times are... time is not on our side, and I think that you know, just to say again, this is not something to be contemplated at leisure. I think our future and the future of our descendants is strongly dependent upon the degree to which we can get this idea that we're all united, and we couldn't secede from nature even if we tried.
True enough. You know, and as I've been covering what's going on in Japan, which doesn't get any coverage in the news,
right.
But it's a very serious situation. So in this instance, we could ask everybody in the world to pray and to put good attention to the Fukushima reactors, and that the right science and the right technology and the right intention is going to be brought to bear, because that is an example right now that's affecting the whole planet and that doesn't get discussed.
Well, to say nothing of the violent weather events from which the people in the Philippines are reeling, even as we speak, with something over 10,000 deaths, which is a predictor of climate change gone crazy.
Yeah, so again, so one mind is an affirmation that what we focus our attention on and the intention we bring to it makes a profound difference. Anything else, Larry, you want to share with us in the remaining minute?
Well, I think... we ought to look at the one mind as a kind of a spiritual, part of a spiritual quest, because part of the spiritual goal of all the wisdom traditions has been to connect with something greater than the individual ego and sense of self. And the one mind really does that. And that's why it's a thoroughgoing spiritual exercise to read a book like this, I think, if I may be permitted to say so. Because it can help us get us beyond the sense of self and ego on which our future is going to depend.
Well, amen to that, and I think you've done just a stunning job. One Mind, How Our Individual Mind is Part of a Greater Consciousness and Why It Matters, a Hay House 2013 release. You can also go to dossey.com, and also a link at 21stcenturyradio.com.
Talk around the clock and breaking news now on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio, I'm Bill Vitka.